A friend of mine grew up in the Midwest and was raised in a rather strict and literal branch of Christianity. There was a great deal of attention paid to not just the how we should live now, but also to the why we live this way. So one day, I think my friend was around 12 years old, he came home from school eager to share with his brother what had happened that morning in homeroom. As soon as he opened the door, he called out his brother's name. There was no response from the surprisingly quiet house. So he called a second time. Again, nothing. Some of you know where this is going. My friend's heart picked up its pace. This is one of those nightmares come to life, because he then called out for his mom, who was always there when he came home from school. Nothing. Not a in the back or upstairs. Just the ticking of the grandfather clock in the hall. And that is when my friend became terrified, because there was no doubt at all in his heart. He had been left behind. Left behind as in two will be in the field. One will be taken and one will be left. Two will be grinding meal together. One will be taken and one will be left. That kind of left behind. Which he wasn't. His family had made a trip to the store and they had forgotten to leave a note. Now, my friend's family was not alone in their interpretation of this part of Matthew's gospel, which we heard this morning. Because in hearing this text, Christians, regardless of what Jesus says pretty clearly at the start, Christians across the centuries and into our day have responded with specific timetables. In this country, you know, the Millerites of upstate New York in the 19th century to Harold Camping of Alameda, California, just a couple of years ago. And because of this text, we have also obsessed about rapturous endings, thereby selling millions of books. Or upon hearing this text, we have responded by avoiding the topic altogether. But my sense is that in all of our responses, for many, if not all of us, there is a deep longing for the reordering of this world. For what we see and hear and experience around us does not meet with God's vision of what this kingdom of heaven is like. Whether we place our energy in calibrating the appointed day and hour, or in what this rapture might be like, or in our complete avoidance, this longing for a reordering remains. And so what is a Christian? Faithful to text, to tradition, and to thought, what is a Christian to do? For I understand that whatever this second coming of Christ will be like, it will be like a thief in the night. Right? As in the days of Noah, a surprise which slips by us while we send email, while we look for a preschool, while we shop for groceries or check our retirement accounts. But given this desire for a reordering and this instruction to stay awake, what are we to do? What does it mean to be ready when you can't even know when you will be tested? It is precisely because we wait for what cannot be known that one scholar beckons us to develop the art of watchful living. To develop the art of watchful living. Now, pay attention to this, because this is a theme that will play out this year as we delve deeper and deeper into Matthew's gospel. This notion that as we wait for kingdom come, that Jesus is surprisingly present in this will being done. If we but pay attention. If we but pay attention. And so this is why our worship this season of Advent, this time that we are present to arrival, this is why it looks different. Right? This is why it sounds different, why it even smells different. Because in the cacophony of our culture, at our look at the bright shiny object culture, it can be tremendously challenging to reveal the signal within the noise. And yet, at its heart, this is just what an apocalypse is. It's a revealing, quite literally, a parting of the veil. It allows us to glimpse among us here the vision that God has for the created. A vision that has been held up for us for millennia, and one which we still struggle to comprehend. On opposite shores of the Isle of Manhattan are two very distinct, very different visions of security in this world. On the west side of Manhattan, berthed where 46th Street meets the Hudson River, floats the USS Intrepid, an aircraft carrier commissioned in 1943 that has served in three wars and in several conflicts in between. It now serves as a museum, offering glimpses into what serving on a warship was like. Directly across town, where that same 46th Street meets the East River, stands a gift to the United Nations from the former Soviet Union, a statue entitled, "Let Us Beat Swords into Plowshares." One street, two shores. This copper statue is a visual representation of this passage from Isaiah that we heard this morning. It is of a man beating a sword with a hammer and anvil, attempting to bend the metal into a tool that will turn up earth, preparing it for planting. Now, I offer these two visions this morning because I recently saw this passage from the prophet in a new light. And once again, our context is critical because our current understanding of this part of Isaiah places it in the 8th century BCE, which falls roughly in the beginning of the Iron Age. So why is this important, the beginning of the Iron Age? Well, at this point in human societal evolution, iron had just been invented. Right? It was powerful and it was precious. It changed the nature of human communal living, especially of battle. In our time, though metals have great value, iron and steel are relatively plentiful. In one way of looking at this, we have just restored the practices of closely reusing and recycling metal. For this reason, I think it can be difficult for us to grasp the radical nature of this image, right? It's far too easy to see it either as naively well-intentioned or maybe soft-headed or sentimental. But at the time of the writing of this first part of Isaiah, if you were going to remake your effective and tremendously powerful weapon of iron into an implement of agriculture, meant that it was not going to be available as a weapon of war anymore without great effort. And so a profound choice was being made. And so now this remarkable image becomes a radical revealing, an economic and yes, a political statement of a vision of the kingdom of God. So, I was trying to practice what I preach this last week, and I was trying to develop this art of watchful living. And so I could not help but stagger at the news of the newest descendant of the USS Intrepid. For those who did not hear, a few weeks ago, the United States Navy christened what will be its newest aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald Ford. Targeted for completion in the year 2016, the USS Ford also made news recently because of reports that it was projecting a 22% cost overrun. Now, unfortunately, a federal cost overrun in and of itself is not unusual, and it's probably not news. But what stunned me is that this cost overrun by itself, just the cost overrun, is roughly $2 billion. Billion with a B. Because the total cost of this one warship, which will have technological capabilities that far outstrip any other vessel that sails the seven seas, the total cost of this one warship is now approaching $13 billion. This in a country whose defense spending exceeds the defense spending of the next 10 countries combined. In 2012, the United States spent roughly $682 billion on defense and international security concerns. The countries of China, Russia, the UK, Japan, France, Saudi Arabia, India, Germany, Italy, and Brazil combined spent $30 billion less than we did alone. This is the tax dollars that you and I pool together. And the large majority of the countries I just listed are our allies. Now, friends, I don't have the answers to what I acknowledge are large and complex questions of foreign policy. But I believe that we have deluded ourselves that this overwhelming investment in the weapons of war hasn't had a corresponding effect on our commonly held domestic and international life. Again, so I'm trying to cultivate this art of watchful living. And so I've been wondering, what vision of a kingdom does the USS Ford offer us? Is this vision consistent with the words and deeds of Jesus and of this kingdom of heaven? And so I've wondered, what would happen in this country, in this world, if just 5% or 10% of these proverbial swords and spears, we weren't going to learn war no more? I wonder what might be revealed if we enact what a majority of Republicans, Democrats, and independents have said they want to see, which is far less military spending than either political party has proposed. What might we do with these commonly held resources in this country and in the world? What glimpse into the kingdom of heaven might we reveal? Friends, this is a question to remain with us this week and in these weeks to follow as we approach the glorious impossible. It's a question to really honestly ask of ourselves, of our families, of our church, of our workplaces, our cities, our government, our society. In our words and in our deeds, what glimpse, what kingdom is being revealed? For it's just too easy for us to fall into patterns of complacency, of just not seeing what is around us, of assuming that as long as we are fed and housed and safe and healthy, then others must be as well. And if they're not, well, then maybe the pie just isn't big enough. Or that what we have now, built upon power as the sole provider of protection, that it always must be. Friends, this is a day when the days have grown dark, the night has grown long. Stay awake. Stay awake, for the world is about to turn. A light shines in the darkness, and it is for us to point the way.